only after he had already been ousted from office the first time, his aide said, when a military coup d'etat deposed him in 1991 and forced him into exile in the United States. He began immersing himself in the growing scholarship on a history that even as Haiti's president, he knew little about. After the Americans helped restore him to power, he was re-elected in 2000 and intensified his research into Haiti's past. He would call many times asking for more information, recalled Dr. Francis Saint-Hubert, a Haitian physician who had studied the links between the abysmal state of public health in Haiti and the money siphoned off by France. On the bicentennial anniversary, Jean-Bertrand Aristide upped the political ante by declaring the precise amount he said France owed Haiti. $21,685,135,571. French diplomats and some Haitians mocked the multi-billion-dollar figure as a misguided publicity stunt by a demagogue trying to maintain his grip on power. A group of 130 Haitian intellectuals denounced the restitution campaign as a desperate attempt to distract attention from the Jean-Bertrand Aristide government's totalitarian drift, incompetence and corruption. A French foreign ministry spokesman said France did not need to take lessons from Haiti's leaders. But a New York Times analysis of the long-term damage done by sending enormous sums of money to France shows that Haiti's losses may have been surprisingly close to Jean-Bertrand Aristide's figure of $21.68 billion. In fact, his estimate may have been a bit modest. The New York Times scoured thousands of pages of archival government documents to determine how much Haiti sent to France over the course of generations, not just in official payments to former slaveholders, but also for a loan to help pay them. The New York Times found that Haiti paid France a total of $560 million in today's dollars. But that only begins to account for the loss. With the help of 15 leading economies from around the world, we modelled what might have happened if that money had gone into the Haitian economy, rather than being siphoned off to France without getting any goods or any services in return. The New York Times' estimates found that over time, the payments to France cost Haiti from $21 billion to $115 billion in lost economic growth. Put in perspective, that is anywhere from 1 to 8 times the size of Haiti's entire economy in 2020. We were building a path to the truth, Jean-Bertrand Aristide said in the interview, without being told the outcome of the New York Times' analysis.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Wa kun Allahumma bi'izzatika li fi kulli al-ahwal raufa wa 'alayya fi jami'i al-umur 'atufa. Ilahi wa rabbi, man li ghayrak as'aluhu kashfa dharri wan nadhara fi amri.
Brothers and sisters, we were talking about this part of the Kumail supplication. Ilahi wa rabbi, man li ghayrak as'aluhu kashfa dharri wan nadhara fi amri. My Allah and my Lord, have I got anyone but you from whom to ask remedy of my affliction and regard for my affairs? We said, and we concluded earlier, that the true supplicant, the true servant, should seek refuge to only Almighty Allah and no one else for the remedy of his afflictions. He should ask his request to be granted only from the Almighty Allah. And of course, in cases that he has introduced us some mediators. So the true servant should detach himself from anyone and anything, from all creatures of the Almighty Allah. Just like he is in the middle of the ocean, drowning. He has got no one else to turn to, no reliance on anyone and anything other than the Almighty Allah. We mentioned a couple of stories, amazing tales about the instances of Almighty Allah's mercy and attention to the ones who have cut themselves off from anything other than Him. Now let us have a look at another instance. The biography of the King Mahmud Ghaznawi reads, "One day he passed by the seashore. He saw a sorrowful youngster who had spread his net for fishing. There, the king asked the young man the reason for his sadness. He replied, 'My seven brothers and I are poor orphans, and we have an elderly mother. After my father's death, I've been responsible for making a living for my family. But every day, I can catch only one or two fish, which is not sufficient for the expenses of our big family.' The king told him, 'Would you like me to help you with the fishing today?' The young man, of course, accepted. So the king told him again, 'Pull out the net in the name of your co-worker this time.' The young man waited for a while, then took the ropes of the net to pull it out, but he couldn't. So the king and his servants helped him pull it out. When it was pulled out of the water, there were lots of fish in it. After returning to the palace, the king sent someone to bring his co-worker to him. He placed him beside himself, behaving kindly towards him, and everyone said, 'This is a poor man whose place is not beside you.' But the king answered, 'He is my co-worker and should benefit from whatever I possess.' In other words, when the regard of a worldly king improves someone's life to this extent and alleviates his troubles, how influential is the regard of a true king whose perfection is infinite, whose mercy is countless?
Therefore, my Lord, I ask you by your greatness not to let my sins and my misdeeds veil my supplications from you. and not to disgrace me by exposing those of which you have knowledge, nor to hasten my retribution for those vices and misdeeds committed by me in secret, which were due to evil-mindedness, ignorance, excessive lustfulness, and my negligence. O Allah, I beg you by your greatness to be compassionate to me in all circumstances, and be gracious to me in all affairs. My God, my nourisher, have I anyone except you from whom I can seek the removal of my afflictions and understanding of my problem?
Thank you, Allah, God, that we hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
The Almighty Allah, the absolute cause, is really merciful, is really having regard for the one who has turned to him for his material and spiritual needs. He is aware of the servants who have cut themselves off from anything and anyone other than him. Allah's regard out of his mercy is a kind of regard that saved Prophet Noah and the believers from the horrible storm. This attention, this regard of the Almighty Allah is the very one that turned Moses' staff into a snake to oppose Pharaoh's tyranny. This is the kind of Allah that rescues the Israelites from among the Nile's turbulent waves. This is the one that saved Prophet Yusuf from the deepness of the dark well, bringing him to the kingdom of Egypt. This is the kind of Allah that responds to the ones who have detached themselves from anyone except Him. Brothers and sisters, we are done explaining this part of the Divine Kumail supplication. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. In explanation of this part of the Kumail supplication as well, I took great help from the commentary on Kumail supplication available at al-islam.org. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting.
The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in Australia. Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday, and the opposition Labour Party was set to end almost a decade of Conservative rule, possibly with the support of pro-environment independents. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. He said he wanted to unite the country. He told his supporters, "I think people want to come together. Look for our common interest, look towards that sense of common purpose. I think people have had enough of division. What they want is to come together as a nation, and I intend to lead that." Labour has secured a parliamentary majority in general elections, but Albanese may still need a coalition partner to rule. He has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The new Labour government promises to reset Australia's relations with the world. Albanese has also promised to create stronger ties with Asia. He said, "We live in a region whereby in the future we will have China, India, and Indonesia as giants. We need to strengthen that economic partnership, and one way that we can do that is by strengthening people-to-people relations as well." Labour has promised more financial assistance and a robust social safety net as Australia grapples with the highest inflation since 2001 and soaring housing prices. The party also plans to increase minimum wages. Others will be watching closely to see if Albanese's premiership brings a less hawkish tone on China and whether ministerial meetings with Beijing resumes after a more than two-year hiatus. On the foreign policy front, it has proposed to establish a Pacific Defense School to train neighboring armies in response to China's potential military presence on the Solomon Islands. In late April, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact with China. The outgoing Australian leader was highly critical of China in particular and Asian countries in general. He had earlier accused his main opponent of being Beijing's preferred candidate. Relations between China and Australia have strained since 2018 when Australia became the first country to ban the Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G wireless networks. Australia has long been known as the lucky country, partly due to its wealth of coal and gas, as well as minerals like iron ore, which have driven generations of economic growth. But it's now sitting on the frontier of a climate crisis, and the fires, floods, and droughts that are expected to become more extreme due to the rising global temperatures. Labour wants to tackle climate change with an ambitious 43% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It also has pledged to reach emission net zero by 2050, partly by strengthening the mechanism used to pressure companies to make cuts. To speed up the transition to renewable energy, Labour plans to modernise Australia's energy grid and roll out solar banks and community batteries. But despite its net zero commitment, Labour says it'll approve new coal projects if they're environmentally and economically viable. The Conservative government had been called a climate holdout by the United Nations Secretary General after outlining a plan to get to net zero by 2050 by creating massive new gas projects. Incumbent Scott Morrison had said he would back a transition from coal to renewable energy, but had no plans to stop new coal projects.
Oh, the legacy is awful. We have the worst climate change policies on the planet, courtesy of this government. They were promoting new coal mines. A huge part of their argument was we had to open up more mines as fast as possible. So it was, you know, crashing headlong into climate change and denying any role in it. Foreign policy was a joke.
Elena Doohan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, who was on a mission to Iran from May 7th to 18th, has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane.
Iran has been subjected to a broad scope of unilateral sanctions for a long period of time already. In particular, the United States has imposed economic, trade, and financial sanctions on Iran since the late 1970s, with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995, and measures to isolate Iran from the international commercial and financial system. These were expanded in mid-2000, and again after 2010, extending to many economic sectors.
U.S. sanctions also targeted Iran's central bank as well as commercial banks. The EU adopted restrictive measures and comprehensive economic and trade sanctions against Iran in 2010, supplemented by an oil embargo in 2012, and trade prohibitions involving key sectors and the freezing of assets of the Iranian central bank, Iranian shipping and shipbuilding sector, and a number of persons and entities, and restrictions on financial services, as well as exports and imports. In May 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, under which the international sanctions on the Islamic Republic were eased in exchange for Tehran putting limitations on certain aspects of its nuclear activities. The U.S. then reinstated harsh economic sanctions on Iran and slapped new ones that barred countries and international firms from working with Tehran. Doohan said the U.S. continues to ban trade and investment in Iran, forcing foreign companies to leave the country for the fear of the sanctions. Many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical and medical companies around the world, overcomply with sanctions out of fear of potential penalties. The U.N. rapporteur stated that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip Iranians of their basic rights to health. The top U.N. human rights official highlighted that applying extraterritorial sanctions on Iranian companies or companies working with Iran is illegal under international law. Doohan added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's effort to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions.
Human rights in Iran are severely affected by the use of unilateral sanctions. The most close to every single individual sphere is the sphere of health. The situation in Iran is the following, that some medicine are produced domestically. At the same time, the raw materials are imported. And then it comes the issue again of payments, deliveries, the quality of delivered raw materials. When it comes to the rare or severe diseases, there is no possibility to deliver that.
Commenting on Iran's frozen assets abroad, the UN official said the assets estimated to be around $120 billion need to be unblocked. Duhan began her 11-day visit to Iran on May 7th, a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. illegal withdrawal from the JCPOA. She also referred to stalled negotiations in Vienna to bring the U.S. back to the JCPOA, urging the signatories and the U.S. to resume the negotiations. In the end, Duhan called on sanctioning states, the U.S. in particular, to abandon their policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries. Economic sanctions are the policy tool of choice for the United States to force countries to bend if they don't follow Washington's foreign policy objectives in many cases. Yet they have failed to bring the desired result, as they might generate some meaningful behavioral change in the targeted or sanctioned country about 40% of time.
We know that sanctions really don't work as far as convincing or having leaderships of different countries change their decision making or their behavior. So I think over the years we've learned that nothing's going to change with the continued sanctions.
Unilateral sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. In sanctioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Yemen, medical equipment is rather outdated, and they suffer shortages of medicine and protective means. One of the reasons is that payment systems are not available to buy and have medicine enter the respective countries. For instance, Iran was the scene of a serious economic and health crisis, hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The embargo put in place by the United States threatened the lives of many Iranians. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington attempts to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate governments of other countries, something it has done in the case of Venezuela and Cuba. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter.
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries, so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February. As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
Tensions between Russia and Israel appear to be on the rise. Israeli media reports say Russian forces have opened fire on Israeli jets with advanced S-300 anti-aircraft missiles. The missiles were fired at Israeli warplanes after they attacked targets in northwestern Syria. The move is seen as a sign of significant shift in Moscow's attitude toward Israel. The unprecedented incident is said to have occurred on Friday night when Israeli jets targeted an area near the city of Masyaf, which killed several people. Israel's airstrikes on targets in Syria are countered by the country's anti-aircraft missile batteries. But this time, however, the S-300 batteries also opened fire as the jets were departing the area.
It is the case that these missiles, the S-300 battery, is operated by Russian military personnel, and that they would not have fired without permission from senior commanders, okay? This is a break in the normal procedure.
Syria's S-300 batteries are operated by Russian military and cannot be fired without their approval. Israeli media reports claim the S-300 radar did not manage to lock onto the Israeli jets and thus did not present a serious threat to the fighter jets. But this would mark the first use of the S-300s against the Israeli warplanes over Syria. It's not clear whether the S-300 missile fire was a one-time event or if it was a Russian signal to Israel that it was changing its policy.
So this was the first use of it, and it was known to be done by Russian military personnel at Russian military command. But it also, they did not lock the radar on the planes. So the planes were never in danger. It's unclear from the reports whether they couldn't lock the radar on the planes or whether they just didn't lock them and just wanted to throw these missiles up there as a kind of signal and a warning to Israel that, you know, we may change our policy and we may take down some planes.
The development comes amid deteriorating relations between Tel Aviv and Moscow over Ukraine. Israel has backed Ukraine after the war began. Tel Aviv's stance has angered Russia. Russia's latest move against Israel would be a worrying development for Israel.
And that has to do, of course, with the whole reverberations of what's going on with Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians are realizing that and starting to act much more militantly, in the sense that they understand this is now a war for the future of a lot of things.
The Tel Aviv regime has repeatedly targeted the positions of the Syrian army and its allies, but has rarely acknowledged or discussed such operations. The aerial bombardment intensified in scale and frequency after 2011, when the Arab country found itself in the grip of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism.
Oh, it will continue. No question about it. Look, it's not going to even think about stopping until a plane goes down. If S-300s or some other effective anti-aircraft defense takes down Israeli planes, then there'll be a problem. So the Russians have signaled something here, and they didn't take down a plane. And until and unless they do, Israel's not going to change its policy on that at all. And even if they do, that would cause a problem for Israel, and they would have to think twice about it.
Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out attacks on the Arab country to aid terrorist groups against the Syrian army. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, calling the aggression a blatant violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. The development comes after warmongering rhetoric of Israeli officials against Iran and its allies. Just recently, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Tel Aviv would prevent Iran from transferring advanced capabilities to its allies in the region. But Iran has dismissed the threat, saying it's determined to help the resistance axis stand up against Israel's aggressive moves in the region.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful,
Welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
حرامخواری این وضعیت رو داره که شیطان رو شریک میکنه تو زندگی و تو مال آدم. عجبا.
Haram earning and haram income is one of the main traps of the Satan for the believers. Some people share their earning with the Satan and some believers share their income with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Sharing your income with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam means to dedicate some parts of your earnings to the majalis of this holy Imam and spend in the way of Allah.
بعضی‌ها شریک امام حسین میشن تو کاسبیشون.
We have so many traders or sellers who share their income and earnings with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and spend it in the way of Allah. This is how they keep Satan away from their financial life and bring halal abundance to their money. On the other hand, we may find people who become the partner of the Satan through unlawful trading and business. We, as believers, must be very much careful about our financial incomes. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a wildflower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate. A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtanaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Deshanaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment, and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rock hopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, which winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through straight buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make five blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.